I did not come here expecting to lead tonight, and John did not come here expecting to speak tonight. So, John, thank you for stepping up to the plate. Come on up, buddy. Let's do this.
Hi, everybody. My name's John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
How's the sound?
Good.
Hey, Rhett, how about a bottle of water when you get a chance? I have more respect for this fellowship than to show up at a speaker's meeting to speak in flip-flops and an open-collar shirt, so apologize for my appearance tonight. I would normally wear pants and a tie or something, but we'll get her done. It's a special night tonight. Usually when I do this, I like to read a little bit of our AA scripture before I get started, just to kind of help settle me down a little bit and maybe remind some of you guys, what we're doing here. So this is a portion of our basic text out of chapter 3, the first couple pages of More About Alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs, they never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only. Limiting the number of drinks. Never drinking alone. Never drinking in the morning. Drinking only at home. Never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines and craft beers, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever, with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum. So, like I said, I'm John, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm proud to have the opportunity to talk about one of my favorite subjects in the whole world, me. I'm proud to and grateful that I can carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous maybe to somebody that's here tonight. So we had one newcomer in her first 30 days. Welcome. Who here is in their last 30 days? Can you show of hands? Yeah, I got one, huh? All right. I say that because When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was definitely in my last 30 days of being here. I was not interested in what was happening here. I had not yet, at that time, proven to myself that I was a real alcoholic and I was not in control of how much and when I took alcohol. I still was under the assumption and the false belief that I was somehow in control of my own destiny. Up until that point, yeah, I had drank a little too much, got a little bit too much trouble. But when I thought it was going to be time to stop drinking, I was just going to put it down. You know, simple as that. I just didn't want to, right? I had to be shown. I'm going to tell you about that tonight. I'm going to take you through the steps of what it took for me to understand what it meant to be real, what it means to be a real alcoholic. Having lived that life and gone through those steps, I can tell you what a miracle it is tonight for anybody in this room to have 24 hours of sobriety. So if you're that person that's feeling like you're in your last 30 days of sobriety here, that you're here against your own, you're here against your will, that yeah, you'll do it for a couple of days and a week or two to get somebody off your back or get that court card filled out and get on down the road. If you are a real alcoholic like me and you've got a couple of days sober or maybe one day sober, a profound miracle has already occurred. Because people like myself and people like you, if you're like me, don't stay sober. I want you to understand how important that is to know. Most of us don't take very much time to think about all the people that we know who couldn't get one day sober. We don't usually sit around and ponder that. When I sit down and think about the people that I've known that have gone on to death as a result of alcoholism, I'm struck by the fact that many of them were exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous at some point. There were some people in my life that were very close to me who had given every opportunity to get sober. One family member in particular did many years in prison and went to meetings in prison and was sent to on court cards to AA meetings, had parole officers putting him through detoxes. He had more exposure to AA than probably I had when I got sober. Yet he could never get that one day sober, you know, for whatever reason. Now, I don't deserve the life I have any more than he deserves to be dead. But for whatever reason, I'm here and he's not. So I understand that a real miracle has happened in my life. And if you're here tonight and you're sober, a real miracle has happened to you. You know, many of us think that, especially early on starting out in AA, that, you know, life is unfair and life is not the way it should be. You know, when I got here, you know, I had a lot of problems and I didn't know how I was ever going to solve most of them, right? I was not happy with my life. I was not happy with my circumstances. I definitely didn't have all the things I wanted. And I could not see. I was sitting around, I think, for a long time around here, kind of waiting for something special to happen. Not realizing that something special had already happened. I was able to put one day of sobriety after another day of sobriety, after another day of sobriety, after another day of sobriety, and those days start to add up. So my sobriety date is January the 15th, 1987. That's 31 years ago. Ronald Reagan was president. A lot of things have happened since then, okay? I did not stay sober on good intentions, bad coffee, and bad memories for this long. I tried it for a while. It only gets you so far. I'll follow up on that later in the talk. But suffice it to say, I go to 3 meetings a week. After 31 years of sobriety, I go to 3 meetings a week regularly. I have a home group. It's the Tuesday night men's group in Chula Vista. Meets at Hilltop and L at 7:30. I go to dinner and eat really bad tacos at a really crummy taco shop with a bunch of guys from my meeting, and we sit there and yuck it up before the meeting. So this whole affair is, you know, 3-4 hours out of my day on a Tuesday night. You would think that a big important person such as myself would have something better to do on a Tuesday night, but I don't. In fact, I'm living proof that you can stay sober for 31 years and really not amount to much. The point being is that I'm actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. My life and Alcoholics Anonymous are intertwined. And as you heard, when Mary took her cake, and happy birthday, Mary, and I'll agree on those hugs. She kisses real good, too, just FYI. Bud's not here, so. My life and Alcoholics Anonymous are intertwined. You know, AA has given me a life, and I have made a life in Alcoholics Anonymous with the people in AA. And it's been a good life. So I was born in Oxnard, California, which is in Ventura County, which is 60 miles north of Los Angeles and 60 miles south of Santa Barbara on the coastline. My dad's a farmer. My brother and I were ashamed of our dad when we were kids because he drove a dusty pickup with mud on the wheel wells, and everybody else's dad seemed like they were way cooler than our dad. Actually, they probably worked in an oil field or something, but to us, because nobody worked on a farm except for us. Now it's cool to be a farmer, but back then it was kind of lame. So grew up in Oxnard, and it was a really good place to grow up. Because it was kind of country still, and like I said, my dad's a farmer. So you really got the best of both worlds. We had Los Angeles was right there. We had a lot of cholos in town. We had lowriders, and we did all that. And, we spray painted graffiti on tractors, and it was like Bakersfield on, like mini Bakersfield, I guess, Bakersfield on the coast. We used to call Oxnard where the sewer meets the sea. But we didn't know IB was here, so I didn't know that there was another place where that happened, So, but it's just as bad up there. It was a good place to grow up. My dad was a hard drinking man. He's a man's man. He had big strong hands and a strong back, and he had a lot of discipline. And there was a lot of things you could get in trouble with my dad for. You could get in trouble with my dad for almost anything, but drinking was not one, okay? That one was off limits. He couldn't say shit because he was drunk all the time. And so I grew up really kind of soaked in liquor. And I think a lot of us probably grow up that way. We were just, my dad and his buddies, they bought beer by the pallet, man. They didn't buy it by the case. They had it delivered, and the guy would bring a pallet jack, and he would put the pallet in the garage. I didn't know. I just thought that's how you bought beer. I never, buy it by the pallet, Michelob, that was their, they drank Michelob. It's terrible tasting stuff to this, even to this day, I can't stand the taste of it, but... it was a terrible taste and stuff, but I drank a lot of it. I grew up soaked in alcohol. So I'm not one of those guys that can really tell you when I took my first drink, really, because it was everywhere. My mom didn't buy cough syrup. She used wild turkey. It's the same thing, right? And I was faking, I was a little kid faking a cough, you go to the bottle, I loved the taste of alcohol. I loved it. I didn't have a problem with the taste of alcohol. I didn't. That whiskey, when it went into my mouth and down my throat, you take that gulp of whiskey and it would just go all the way down to the bottom of my toes, man, and it would... my toenails would go out like that, and then it would just come right back up, and it would just fill me up like I was glowing, like superpowers, like I was like a superhero, change, like Power Rangers, I just, I don't know how to explain it. It was like rays of light were coming off of me. You know, I just felt it was the most profoundly good feeling I can explain. I can't really explain it. I drank it as often as I could. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. For me, alcohol was like water or Bondo. It just filled in the low spots, right? It just smoothed everything out. You know, I was just not so, you know, that tension would just come out of your neck and just, you know, because, hey, life's hard, you know? I grew up, I was a white kid in a Mexican neighborhood. That was, you know, tricky. The first time I ever saw a 64 Impala, I used to say it was a 64 Impala, but that car was probably too new in those days. It was probably like a 48 Ford or something. You know, I was walking to school and I see these guys come bouncing down the road with their slicked hair and their Pendleton shirts and all that, you know, and I'm looking at this car and the guy goes all the way across like three lanes of traffic to hit the curb, to splash the puddle, to douse me, right? And then he drives off, you know, and I remember reaching down, found it like a rock or something, and I threw it at that car, man, and it hit the car, bang! And I saw the brake lights come on. And then all these cholos come piling out of that car, man. I start running back, you know. But I tell you that story because those guys were so cool, man. You know, they had their, you know, their shirts up to here, you know, and then they, you know, the little, and it just, you know, and their girlfriends were just mean, like mean Mexican girls, you know, and I really developed a. I don't know when it started, maybe in elementary school. I liked those mean, mean Mexican girls. You know, they're just mean, you know, just tough, you know. And there was a lot of things happening. This was the late 70s, and there was this whole thing going on in L.A., this whole dog town, and punk rock was happening. And we had this little scene in Oxnard where some of you that are about the same age as me would probably know a little bit about that. And so there was this whole thing. We were we were surfers and skateboarders and punk rockers and lowriders all at the same time, you know, and criminals and whatever else, you know. I just kind of fell into that lifestyle because it was just a natural progression, you know. I liked the drinking. I liked alcohol in all its forms, powdered forms, rock forms, you know, leaf forms. And all that just kind of mixed together, and it just created a lifestyle. You know, very early in my drinking, I kind of developed what I thought was going to be my my image, you know, or like who I was, right? My thing, you know, the word is escaping me now, but, you know, my thing, my image. I was going to roll with that. You know, I rejected everything I learned at home. Like I said, my parents are hardworking Michiganders and my brother and I were born here. My dad had been to Vietnam when he got out of the Navy and Port Hueneme there. My brother and I were both born here in Oxnard. And so we were Californians. My parents were, you know, farm people from Michigan. My dad grew up on a legitimate family farm, you know, outdoor plumbing kind of place. My mom, not a little bit better. They were kind of in town, but still pretty rural. And so they weren't really understanding what was happening around here in California. They dressed us funny. You know, I wore hand-me-downs from like the kids down the street because I was the oldest brother. So my mom somehow managed to find hand-me-downs, even though there was, I don't know where, you know, like the thrift store maybe, I guess. But, you know, it was tough. But I rejected all that. And I was very quickly in my little thing, and because drinking was wonderful and it worked. You know, I tell the guys that go to my Tuesday meeting, I tell a story. I mean, if I could freeze time, I can say with a certainty, I don't want to return to drinking, and I don't want to ever take another drink of alcohol again, so, you know, God willing. But if I had to pick one day, you know, 1983, you know, riding the kid down the street, Jojo Ramirez, had a Cadillac. It was like an 82 Cadillac, so it was pretty new. You know, it had the true spoke rims on it, man. It was all slammed down, had hydraulics. We got the Mad Dogger sunglasses, you know, and everybody in the car has a nickname like Sapo, Chewy, you know, Oso, you know. I don't know how many people are in the car, like 15, right? We're all in that car. And we're sitting at the light at Ventura Road, at Wynemi Road and Ventura Boulevard, and the turn signal's blinking along to no parking on the dance floor, you know, do. And I'm just wasted, and I'm just sitting there, and everything is working perfect, man. I mean, the chicks are walking, they're checking us out, like, whoa, you know, and we're just, yeah, hey, what's up, you know, and we're just, it just, that drinking made that happen. That couldn't have happened without drinking. Nobody does that without being you look stupid, you know. All the adults were like, these guys, you know, but, you know, we're, you know, okay, you know, we're just, but it was wonderful. I don't want to try to make anybody, give anybody the impression that alcohol didn't do something for me. It's most certainly did. It was a wonderful thing. I loved it. What I didn't know at the time is that I was beginning a process where I thought that I was drinking when I wanted to. And maybe I kind of was, but it was very quickly changing. I was pretty much staying wasted all the time. You know, I prior to getting to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had reached a point in my drinking where I was sloppy drunk all the time. I wasn't really a maintainer kind of drunk guy. There's a lot of alcoholics that go through life for many years, and a lot of people, other than the fact that they smell like a brewery, because you can never hide that, you know, even though they think they can, you can't, right? They can kind of act normal, you know, like a lot of people that after they get sober, if you've known a chronic alcoholic, like in the workplace or something, and then they get sober, it's like all of a sudden they're a different person, but like they were like two different personalities, but the personality they had before was fairly normal, right? I wasn't that guy. You know, I had no personality. I was just sloppy drunk all the time. You know, I drank excessively, constantly. I'm here to tell you that I wasn't drinking to try to escape any particular thing. I was drinking because I have an obsession of the mind and a physical compulsion of the body. When I put alcohol into my body, something changes, and I must drink more. If I took a cap full of whiskey standing here at this podium, I'd have to hit the liquor store by the time the meeting was over. I mean, that's just the way it works for me. If you're not in your head, hey, remember what I said in the beginning. If you've got 24 hours, right? So that was the process. The process was beginning. It culminated in a lot of sordid scenes, as you can imagine. Started getting in trouble with the law. At first when I was young and I'd get in trouble and go to juvenile hall, it's kind of like going to summer camp, you know. It was like see kids from other towns you didn't know. We didn't travel a lot, you know, so we'd meet kids from Simi Valley and shit, and it was kind of cool, you know, like, oh, wow, you live all the way in Simi Valley. Wow, what's that like, you know? But then it started to get a little more serious, right? And I was pretty much constantly in a state of probation, and I was in a lot of trouble all the time. And not only that, this image that I had and this lifestyle that I thought I was living, like I said, I was, you know, I was Tom Curran and Tony Hawk at the same time, and Jesse James and who else, you know, you name it. I was trying to be that guy, you know, and I had no physical coordination anymore. I was kind of remembering there was a period there at the end of my drinking, like I would try to go surfing with the boys or whatever, and like I almost drown out there. Like I had no physical coordination left. I couldn't do anything except drink and hang around on a corner and look stupid. That's all I could do. You know, I had nothing left going for me. as I'm reaching the end of this run of alcoholism. So, in my case, I had a probation officer that was convinced that I was an alcoholic, and I needed to go to some AA meetings. Now, I was on probation not for anything that had related to do really with possession or anything like that. It was, it takes one to know one. And as I found out later, this probation officer was actually sober in AA. And I think he was relatively newly sober, which explains why he was trying to 12-step everybody, right? But, you know, so whatever. But, you know, so he puts me on this court card, and I remember going to that first meeting, and of course, my mom's driving me to the meeting, right? Because I'm a tough guy, you know. I live with mom, you know. I don't have a car, right? Mom's driving me. Maybe I'm driving, I don't know, but she's in the car because it's her car. You know, she wants to make sure I go, and we're going. And I remember telling her, you know, okay, I'll go to this AA thing. And obviously, at AA, they have some kind of way where you get things under control, and then I'll stop embarrassing you guys so much. And, you know, we won't have all these problems that we're having, and I won't have all the problems I'm having, and then you can lend me that, you know, $50 I need, and, you know, and all that stuff, right? And she says, yeah, she doesn't know either, right? So she's going, yeah, whatever, she's a good codependent. So we get down to the meeting, and she lets me out, and I go in, and I go to this stupid AA meeting, and I walk in, and there's a person at the podium, some dork just like me, except I know the person. I knew it was a woman that I knew, that I had used and partied with. And I'm like, God, what? No, right? Like, no, you know, I knew this chick was fast, right? I mean, she was, you know, she tried, it was one fast broad, but I knew that we were kind of the same. We kind of knew the same people. We kind of ran with the same crowd. And like, here she's doing the whole, what I'm doing now. Right, except she's got like 9 months sober, you know, and I'm just going, oh my God, really, you know, do I belong here? Am I supposed to do this, you know? And so I had never had any experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know there was 12 steps. I didn't know anything about AA, nothing. And so I'm coming in ice cold, and I sit down, and like I said, Cheryl's speaking, and. Who Cheryl is still sober. Her name's Cheryl Graham. She's still sober to this day, as a matter of fact. And then they, at some point, chips and things are happening. They're panning out chips for length. You know, it's like a courtroom, right? 60 days, 90 days. You know, then they get to the felonies. You know, 5 years, 10 years, right? And I'm like, wait a minute. These people are staying sober off of everything, right? That was, like, up until that point, I was like, I didn't understand that was part of this, okay? Because believe me when I tell you, at that me sitting in that meeting right at that moment, alcohol was the only friend I had. Alcohol was absolutely the only friend I had. And sobriety, when you said to me sobriety, what I heard was misery. What I heard was restless, irritable, and discontent. That's what sobriety meant to me. So the idea that I was going to stop drinking and hang around Alcoholics Anonymous and like try to change my life, I mean, what? No way. So I didn't. I didn't do it. But I was on this court card. So I did kind of bounce around AA for that. This was the summer of 1986, and I was kind of bouncing around AA because I had to get my, you know, I had to pretend at it. To try to keep myself out of trouble, and I even took some chips. I remember I took a 90-day chip. I think I was high when I took it, you know. Whatever. I had no morals. I had no code. Who heck with you guys, you know. I was just a liar, you know. But some of this stuff started to sink in, right? And at some level, I kind of understood that I was like you. Not that I didn't, at that point, I was still believing that I would get sober when I said so. And I just didn't say so yet, right? And then inevitably, the day came. Now, I had been sneaking a few here and there for about a 3-4 month period. I've been sneaking one here, sneaking one there. You get away with that for a time if you're like us. But that inevitably, that day came. I was working on the ranch. That was a whole nother story that I don't really have time for here, but a big part of my drinking was I worked on my dad's farm, with the Braceros out there, and those are some hard drinking, hard living dudes, and they're the ones that taught me, you know, a lot of what I know about being a derelict drunk, you know. But you know, my hands got hard, my back got strong, you know, and my liver got hard, you know. But I'm working on the farm, and it's the middle of the day, and the insanity is on me. The insanity is on me. I'm upset about something. I don't remember anymore what I was upset about, but the insanity was on me, man. It was in my head. That thing was scratching at the back of my brain, telling me, you need a drink, man. F all this. You know, F all these people. F all this being good. You know, you got this. And you've earned it. And by the anyways, who cares? It doesn't even matter. Just get that drink, man. Just do it. And I did it. You know, I walked off my dad's farm out there in the middle of the fields out there in Oxnard. Got out there on Fifth Street. It was about 5 miles to anywhere, and you know, walked into a house, and I got to a house where they'd had a party the night before, and they're like, there was like those red cups with half drinking beers kind of all over the place, you know. And I come up in a house, one of those houses like no one ever went in the front door. We went in and out of a window on the side, like maybe the landlord had put a padlock on the, I don't know, but you know. So there's like the red solo cup of beer kind of sitting up on a fence post, and I took that cup and, you know, and I just, it was all hot and just been sitting out flying, you know, and I just drank it. And let me tell you, I was like a man that had just crossed the desert getting a drink of water, man. I mean, I'm telling you that was like the nectar that I needed. What it really was rocket fuel. And I just lit the fuse. I was like Wile E. Coyote with the roller skates and the rocket on my back. I just lit the fuse, man. You know, this was like September. I don't remember much until the next real thing I remember is sitting on a half-buried wagon wheel in somebody's front yard with the maglight flashlight in my eyes, and they know my name. And then things start getting clearer, and I'm in the county jail. Part of that process, I was sent to I was put through a diversion program, and I was sent down to Panorama City to a place called the Treatment Centers of America. It was through a contract with the County of Ventura. It was a 30-day program. I did 59 days. I was so good. I did 59 days in a 30-day program, left in handcuffs. came in handcuffs and left in handcuffs. They read my thing to the judge. It said maximum treatment value, keep him, you know. I wasn't in that much trouble, and it's getting on into the beginning of 1987, and I'm sitting up there at the county jail, and I got a visitor, and I wasn't expecting a visitor, and I got a visitor, and it was this person, a woman, and I'll tell you that I got sober by Faith. Her name was Faith Suzuki. And Faith came to visit me, and now I haven't told you about Faith, but Faith was was married to one of the partners at my dad's farm, a little Japanese guy named Jim Suzuki, and Faith was his wife. And Faith was Jim's dirty, embarrassing secret, because she was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and she never came out of the house. You know, her grown sons would bring her alcohol and drugs to the back door. I mean, she was a straight-up drug addict. She was a heroin addict. I ran with her sons, and I knew Faith. And what I knew about Faith was that she was the most scariest, disgusting person that you should never trust or ever be around. You know, she chased me out of her house one day with a pistol. She stole money from me. When I was a little kid, she took her false teeth out of her mouth and set them on the table and said, if you're not good, these fucking teeth are going to bite you, you know. And I mean, she was mean, man. She was scary. Yeah, I remember that. You know, I was like 6 years old. My dad leaves me with a drug addict for, you know, to babysit me, you know. This woman was not to be trusted, and I had never heard Faith make a coherent sound or sentence ever in my life. If you've known somebody who's drunk and wasted on pills and heroin for a long time, you know they can't really talk or make any kind of coherent sounds, right? And that was her. And at the time, Faith was about in her 60s. She was, you know, not a young person. So she came to visit me. And I sit down, you know, the tables, you know, in the visiting area, and I sit down, and, you know, I got my little, you know, I probably got creases on my little T-shirt, you know. You know, and she sits down, and she goes, "Hey, John." And I said, "What are you doing here?" And right away, something's different about her, right? And she says, "Hey, I've gotten sober." And I, you know, my jaw, you know, and I, right away I knew there was something different about her. She was clear and she was coherent and she was alive. And I'd never seen her like that before. So what I'm telling you is that the dirtiest, most low-down liar and cheat and thief that I ever knew in my life is the person that brought me the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It probably had to be that way. She brought me a message that had depth and weight, because I had seen what she was, and I saw now what she was not. And it made an impression on me. Later on, it was not in that much trouble, this was probably about 2 to 3 weeks before I was going to be released with time served for what I'd been doing. And, you know, I went back to my little, we had little one-man rooms there, and I went back to my little room, and I thought about what I had just experienced with her, you know, and I, my life played like kind of a movie in my head, you know, and I saw, you know, my mom crying as I'm hauled out of the courthouse, you know, when you're hauled in and the chains and everything, your mom's looking at you and she's crying, and, you know, a girl named Vicky Moskowitz, you know, naked, half in and half out of a hotel room window in Hollywood, dead, you know, with blood running out of her nose, and just the things that alcohol and drugs had taken me to, you know, and the places and walking the streets and seeing my reflection in a Kmart window when they still had Kmart, and looking at the person in the window and like thinking it was somebody else at first, right? And then realizing that was me that I was looking at. You know, I was going to be, I don't know, like the best, I was going to be like a pro surfer or something, you know, I was going to be like, I don't know what, I was going to be some really important person in my life, and here I was just some shuffling, sloppy, drunk dork, you know, just nothing. You know, you could fit my life on the head of a pin. It was that small. And that inconsequential. You know, these thoughts played through my head, and I had this idea. I thought, you know, maybe those people in Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe now I understand. And I got on my knees that night. That was January the 15th of 1987. I got down on my knees, and I said, got next to my little bunk there, and I prayed to God, a God that I didn't understand or even know existed or had never, ever tried to do any business with whatsoever. And I said, "God, help me get back to Alcoholics Anonymous." That's it. That was the most humblest prayer I've said in my life up until and including today, because I meant it with every fiber of my body. I didn't ask God to help me get sober. I didn't ask God to help me get her back. None of that's, I just knew that if I could get back to Alcoholics Anonymous that and get with you all, I could get what I saw that was oozing out of Faith's very existence. That I could be like her, remade somehow, right? So I didn't describe Faith. She was in her 60s at the time, and her hairdo was still from like 1961, so it went up like this, you know, big old beehive, and it was you know, gray, like Marge Simpson, except gray, right? And she drove a little RX-7. So January 21st rolled around and they opened the gates on to open the front door on me there, you know, the little magnetic door, and sent me on my way with the crap that I was wearing, you know, 3 months before that, which was basically a pair of jeans and some old Wallaby shoes and an old barf stained t-shirt, you know. And I dropped a dime in a payphone, and that little RX, you know, called up Faith, and that little old RX-7 pulled up, you know, and she's in there, and she's got her hair inside, you know, like this. You know? I don't recall all the details of that day, but I had a trash bag full of clothes in my parents' garage. That was all my possessions in the world. And, like, in that trash bag, there was probably, you know, like, one sock and, you know, some assorted underwear and, you know, a couple pairs of barf-stained pants and, like, maybe a record, you know, or something, you know. And, you know, we drove that little RX-7 over to my parents' house, and I got that little bag of stuff, you know, and I a car, and, you know, Faith, you know, their hair like this. And we drove over to the Oxnard Alano Club, and the meeting was starting at, like, 6 o'clock or something, and we got up in that meeting, man, and I sat through the meeting, and after the meeting, I went over, and it was when we still smoked in the Alano clubs, you know, and I picked up an ashtray, and I walked over to the trash can for the meeting, and I went like this, dunk, 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 and I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous at that moment. When I dumped that ashtray in that trash can, I was a member of AA, right? Thank you very much. No, you know, obviously, a lot of things have happened since then. This has been a wonderful life. I met her in Alcoholics Anonymous, my wonderful wife, Kim, is here tonight. And, you know, we were at the, I went to the 5:30 happy hour meeting at the Wagon Wheel Lano Club every day till I got her phone number. And I got her, man. Her boyfriend had to go to prison first, but then I was good. It was a match made in heaven. You know, he didn't get paroled for like a year and a half. I had time to figure it out. You know, I saw her at the dance. You know, I saw her at the AA dance, man. You know, the crowd parted. You know, and I saw that hair. You know, she had that big one, and she was just the scariest Mexican you ever saw, man. You know, just scary, mean. You know, like a mean. You know, a lot of things have happened here. There's been the drop of a coin in a payphone has been meant a big change in my life a couple times. You know, when I dropped that dime in the payphone and called Faith that day to come pick me up, I reached a point in my sobriety after I tried to stay sober on good intentions, bad coffee, and bad memories for a time, and it almost worked. You know, I almost pulled it off, but I got real dry, and I got real restless here in Alcoholics Anonymous again. After about 7 years of sobriety, I figured that I had seen all, done all, that I had heard everything you guys had to say, that I knew how this thing worked, and that I was doing it. I was working on self-propulsion at this point. I was doing it on my own, and I went crazy, man. I went crazy. And I reached a point where now a payphone was a quarter by then. That I dropped a quarter into a payphone in North Carolina, of all places. And depending on what happened on the other end of that line was going to determine whether I went into the bowling alley that was across the street and got a beer or a pitcher of beer or not. That's how close I was. And that quarter went down in there, and, you know, and the phone started ringing, and the person picked up on the other end, and it was not. I didn't go drink that night. I got what I thought I wanted out of that conversation, and I didn't go drink. But I had to redouble my efforts. I realized that I'd been laboring under some really bad assumptions that you could do the work, but only kind of. That you didn't really need to understand you didn't really need to study this book. You know, if you want to get real sick around here and just kind of, you know, F off and just be a taker, don't read this book. Don't do it. You know, it's just going to screw it up for you. But I had to redouble my efforts because I to this day, standing here right now, I still am able to remember with sufficient force how bad it was, and it still scares me. But I also know, just as equally important, that I can forget that. It is possible for me to paint myself into a corner that I can't get out of sober with bad living and bad, carrying on in the wrong way. It can happen. You know, when I go to meetings and I hear that guy comes and he sits down and they ask for the guys in their first 30 days and he raises his hand and then later on he shares, he said, yeah, I had 25 years sober. And then I quit going to meetings. You know, my head snaps around when I hear that. I pay attention to those people because this is a life and death errand for me. I am convinced that I am on a life and death errand. Now, I'm no fool. I realize that I've got physical health at this point. So yeah, if I started drinking, unless I had some accident or an overdose or something like that, I probably could go on for some time. You know, physically, I could make it happen. You know, I could run through the bank account, you know, lose the house, all that stuff, and get down homeless and all the stuff that we do. But I could pull that off for, you know, a good several months. I'm not interested, folks. The life that I have sober, I prefer to anything I ever had when I was drinking. I prefer to be sober. And I protect it, and I cherish it. And I take care of it. I treat it like a gift because that's what it is. People in my life have died. And their example has shown me what a gift I have. I married into a big family. My family is relatively small, and the alcoholism is my dad and my brother and myself. My brother not affected. The family I married into is shot through with it, alcohol and drug addiction. Two people, two of my wife's brothers who I was very close to, who I cared for very much, one of them, are both not with us. They died as young men from drinking. And nothing else wrong with them except alcoholism and heroin addiction. Alcoholism on one and heroin addiction on the other. And like I said at the beginning of this talk, those guys, both of them, had been given every opportunity to get sober. And I saw both of them on their deathbed. DEAD, right? Too young. For no reason. Also, I have known people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've known many people over the years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been here for a long time. Not as long as Mary, but it's still a long time. 31 years, long time. I've known a lot of people here. Over the years, I've known a lot of people that were like way smarter than me, way slicker than me, way richer, way this, way just better all the way around, just cooler, you know? Dead. Not here. Hating life. That's not about how smart I am or think I am. It's not about how good my intentions are. It's about how much effort I'm willing to put into doing what's on the steps here. I'm not one of those speakers that gives the talk that explains how the steps. I think you guys have realized that by now because I'm almost done and I'm not going to talk about that. Talk to your sponsor about that. I'm just here to try to motivate you folks. It's real. This is for me a life and death errand. I don't think I have anything else to add, so I'm going to go ahead and sit down. Good night.
John, thank you very much for stepping up. That was terrific. I want to get one more time for John. Michelle and Mary, thank you for sharing your birthdays with us. That's what we do here. Woohoo! Thank you to the ladies of the Women's Auxiliary and the residents of the house for a great dinner tonight. Let's circle up.